Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Ready. It's a bit of a different format of show today, as we experiment with putting some shows together during the week, as it's easier to get people to talk to us during office hours, and it means we can have the odd Sunday evening off as well. Most shows are going to stay recorded live on the stream, such as race reviews and panel shows. We absolutely love the energy the live chat give us, so we won't be abandoning that. But I think putting the odd show together like this gives us options for special guests and specialist guests as well, such as a journalist who wrote a particular story and maybe the author of an interesting blog we saw, as well as short segments brought to us by Missed Apex regulars, such as a driving masterclass. Brad could drop in for 20 minutes in the week, or we could finally get that two-stroke special from Kyle Power. Not my responsibility. That's all on Kyle. But we do find that most people are free on a weekday with office hours, certainly more than they are on a Sunday evening. I guess it's easier to bunk off when you're working from home than it is to get a pass from the family for a Sunday night. So Matt and I, today, we are going to be bringing you interviews with Race Car Engineers Deputy Editor Stuart Mitchell as we talk power units to start the show off. And then we're going to have a listener feedback section with some of your feedback. And we will end the show talking to Tony Cohen-Brown, who has made some waves on TikTok answering basic F1 questions from new F1 fans. But you'd be surprised how many things you thought you knew that maybe weren't quite right. Questions that seem obvious until you actually try to answer them. But first, let's catch up with the interview with Stuart Mitchell. We kicked off by asking Stuart to describe what Race Car Engineering magazine is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Race Car Engineering magazine pretty much does what it says on the cover. It describes and gets into the detail of race car engineering, from everything from, you know, aero to tyres to suspension to power units and everything in between.
And your specialism within that and your background is in power units. But I think one of the key places to start, Matt, and tell me if I'm ruining your plan here, is about Mercedes domination, given that, you know, they've just won their seventh world title as a team. And a lot of that people put down to the power unit.
Well, yeah, the power unit has been given the place of prominence for Mercedes' advantage, which is, you know, I don't know exactly how true that is. Maybe that's something we can find out today. But what better place to start than at the very beginning, the genesis of the Mercedes power unit? How did it come to be such a dominant factor, and not just a dominant factor, but so much better than the competitors when they first turned up in 2014? I mean, I think there's probably a pretty interesting tale behind that.
Yes, absolutely there is. And one of the things that's quite interesting to note is the evolution of the regulations. Yeah, these regulations, the changes to the regulations, actually started way, way, way back in the early 2000s, or say to the mid 2000s, when people started discussing what was going to happen after the V8s were introduced. So essentially, as soon as one set of regulations is introduced, this thought start going on to the next one. So after the V10s, it was the V8s. And then as soon as the V8s were introduced, it was thought started to go ahead about what happens next. I don't know if you guys remember, but the global race engine started to come onto the platform where people were discussing four-cylinder turbo engines. And that's when the likes of Mercedes started to pop up and put their two cents in about what was going to happen next.
It was a bit of a shock when it was V6s and also the low CC count as well. And you know, Lewis Hamilton came on one of the interviews early in 2014 and said, I'm pretty sure my first car had more, you know, engine capacity than that.
My current car has a bigger displacement than that, quite frankly. But is it really true? Because I had long heard that it was Renault that had pushed for an i4, an inline four-cylinder engine with a turbo. Is that actually what happened? Or do you have any more of the behind the scenes on that?
There was a few people who wanted inline four turbocharged engines, specifically a 2-liter inline four turbo engine. And this was the invention. It sort of came about in 2009 when the global race engine came about. And that was a four-cylinder turbo engine. Now, one set of regulations was for a 1.6-liter engine, inline four turbo, and the other was for a 2-liter engine for some of the upper echelons. And that included Le Mans Formula One. And the other echelons that were going to use the 1600 included WRC, which carried that over, and included World Touring Car, which carried that over as well.
So just remind us and me, like when you're talking about global engine, you're talking about a basic engine platform that could be shared across all the top series that the FIA is responsible for?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it could be branded. So it could be manufactured by only a handful of people. And then it could be branded as associated with one company or another, or they could take the regulations and build it themselves. So that was the idea, that it was just going to work in all different classes. And you can wind up an inline four 2-liter engine to, you know, some stupid numbers if you really want to. The likes of not DTM, the Super GT class out in Japan have done so with their i4 and now DTM more recently. Joining in with that platform.
Let me risk looking stupid here. I know it's never happened on Missed Apex podcast before, but what i4 is inline four rather than the V6s that we've got now, where the pistons are coming in at a V, the cylinders are coming in at a V. What is the inherent difference between a V-shaped engine formation and an inline?
Well, the reason why you want to go with a V-shaped formation in the likes of Formula One is because of the stiffness. So the V-shape and therefore the base of it being connected with the bottom of the crankcase, and then the two outer edges being able to support being mounted to the back of the chassis means that it's a lot stiffer. And that stiffness means that you can obviously put more drive through it and it can handle the chassis loads as it's loaded.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying is that the engine is a stressed member of the suspension in a Formula One car, and it would be harder for it to be as stiff if you were running an inline engine versus a V-shaped engine?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So if you imagine the outer diameter, the maximum outer diameter of the inline four versus the V6, then you can obviously see that the tension, the load across the distance is going to be distributed over a wider space. So that's why the stiffness is there.
Hmm. Which naturally begs the question, well, then what would the advantages of an inline engine be versus a V-shaped engine in this particular application?
For the likes of Formula One, it was simplicity. Trying to make everything a little bit simpler. And for the same reasons that all classes of motorsport have been struggling, cost.
So they went from, I'm trying to get through to the evolution of thinking at that time for these regulations. Mm-hmm. They went from, hey, we could have this super cost efficient, simple, universal four. I'm assuming hybrid as well, but inline four with an MGU and all the electrical cubbins. Embarrassing myself trying to mention all the parts there. So they went from that, and then they did a complete 180, and they went, no, let's make bespoke expensive V6s that will prohibit basically any manufacturer jumping in. Like, that's quite a turnaround. We were on a knife edge there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was pretty surprising for everyone. So by the time the regulations were sorted out around 2012, and then the final bits and bobs started to come into play before they printed the final 2014 rule set, it was very odd. It was very odd to have that massive jump from that 2-liter i4 turbo platform, because it made so much sense. And having that structure in place for the 2-liter meant that you could then, as a manufacturer, take that global race engine into other platforms and just wind it up and wind it down. Obviously use cheaper materials, even use off-the-shelf materials and blocks and things like that to go racing in other classes.
So we went from what would have been a formula that where engines really didn't influence things as much because they would be mandated by the sport. We ended up finding ourselves in an era of Formula One that I think will forever be defined as an engine formula. So from a journalist point of view, that must have been really significant to be in the middle of.
It is, and it did make a big difference. But one thing to note that about these regulations is that the V6 part, sort of that block and piston set and crank train, isn't really the most difficult piece about Formula One now. So the fact that it went through these sort of different changes and people started thinking about different engine platforms, that isn't the most difficult piece. It was pretty straightforward when you think about the physics and bolting engine to the back of a tub and having the gearbox behind that and then the whole rear suspension hanging off of that, that a V made more sense because it's stiffer. But in principle, that V6 element of the regulations isn't the difficult piece.
No, Matt.
Well, you're sort of jumping right to the biggest question I wanted to ask. Of all the bits on the current power unit, to me, the MGU-H is still a bit of the most mysterious. I mean, I think everybody knows the MGU-K, kinetic, is if I'm understanding right, is recovered during either a liftoff phase or a braking phase. And it generates, just like a Toyota Prius, for example, it just generates energy for the battery. But how exactly does the MGU-H work? I mean, I know when we first saw it, we're like, oh, it recovers thermal energy from the exhaust. That's not really what's going on. How does it work? And why is it the most expensive and troublesome thing that Formula One has ever encountered?
Okay, that's a good question. But just remember that I'm also in the room. So explain it as if, you know, a small child has to keep up with this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, principally, all of the Prius drivers out there would be very happy to hear what you've just said about their car operating in exactly the same way as a Formula One car does. But in principle, the MGU-H does not recover heat as such. It recovers the energy that is in the exhaust gas stream that turns a turbine that then spins the rotor inside an electrical unit, so a motor generator unit. That's how you get the energy back. So it's a spinning shaft which the turbine is connected to. And of course, on the other side, the compressor is connected to.
Okay, so this is my confusion. We have a turbocharger that is already in the exhaust stream of the engine.
Yes.
No?
Yes, the turbocharger, the turbine side is in the exhaust stream.
And is the MGU-H simply recovering energy from the shaft of that already existing turbine, or is there a secondary one somewhere further along that spins separately to recover that energy?
No, it's just the single turbine that you're allowed in the regulations. So on the exhaust stream, you've got the exhaust gas coming in and turning the turbine. Then in the middle, and then after that, you've got a shaft, which is connected to the motor generator unit. And then on the other side, you've got the compressor unit, which is on the front of the engines.
Good. We all followed that. No further questions and no quizzes. let's get back to Mercedes then briefly, because we set ourselves up for this 2013-2014 crossover period. Now, the new engines, the new hybrid engines came in 2014. Why were Mercedes able to get such a jump? Because they took a team, for example, like Williams, who subsequently, you know, it turned out they really weren't on top of their aero, but they were able to have a car that was essentially 14 rocket launches per lap and just, you know, let the aero get out of the way. How did Mercedes have that advantage so massively and so quickly, and they've more or less sustained some advantage throughout the whole era.
It primarily comes down to the structure of the team rather than them specifically having just one ticket that nobody else did. It's not like they suddenly had one answer that nobody else knew. I mean, there were some elements of that that we can get onto if you want to, but the principal parts are that they had this structure of a team which had an engine platform, engine units, as we say, in Brixworth, and then they were setting up the chassis in the chassis bits in Brackley. And of course, Brackley used to be BAR, and then it used to be a bunch of other teams. I mean, I can't even remember all the history because they've been chopping and changing all sorts. And then famously, of course, in 2010, Mercedes bought the remains of the Braun team, which of course was Honda before that. So that's how that ended up being what it is. But they had no specific ticket. They had no, you know, Willy Wonka's golden ticket that meant that they were ahead of the rest. It's really how they structured the team once they got going.
Okay, so I've bored people at length with my theories on how Mercedes have been just better at development than other teams. It strikes me very much, on very little evidence, it has to be said, but from the outside, that they seem to operate very much like an engineering firm. And, you know, there's a set of requirements that come from the top and go down. So this plan is not really made by an engineer. There might be an overall strategy guy. They split into departments and they say, right, Derek, your job is make sure your airflow there doesn't interfere with the rear wing. Other Derek, your job is to make sure that the fuels are great. You know, the guy who's making those decisions isn't the guy with the technical vision. Whereas with Red Bull, you've got Adrian Newey with his crayon and he's like sketches it all out and says, right, no, guys, now you build that, you make that happen. So how's my amateur assessment of how Mercedes approach things?
It's there or thereabouts that they have that structure in place where it is a top-down kind of solution ultimately, but they have what they call the vehicle performance group at the very top, which is the most senior engineers, and they analyze everything in the greatest detail. And then they have sub-teams underneath them that work on specific areas of the car to improve the performance in those specific areas. So with that sort of Christmas tree shape to their structure,
yeah,
it means that they can move things and make those leaps in various different areas without toppling the whole thing over and without one team just running off with their one ideas whilst another gets left behind or messes up all the others. Their designs and so on.
And how different is that to sort of what you might call, I mean, I don't know if there even is a standard Formula One team practice, because everything else about the sport is kind of bespoke anyway. But how different was that structure, and how valuable has it been to Mercedes, say relative to, I don't know, Red Bull or Ferrari, their immediate competitors?
I couldn't tell you exactly what a standard structure would look like. They're all very, very different. I mean, Williams, for example, most recently have been speaking about how they're a family team. And the structure that they have is to monetize some of the things that they develop within Formula One by using the Williams Advanced Engineering Group. And they've got to work in harmony. So it's almost as if there's a bit of conversation about whether or not they can do some things if they're not going to then be able to benefit from them in another sector or selling that technology elsewhere. Whereas Mercedes structure is Mercedes Grand Prix Limited. It's a business solely responsible for making race cars go fast around tracks. You know, Renault, on the other hand, is basically owned by the French people. So it's very difficult to say what is a standard structure, but the Mercedes, you know, solution seems to be the most effective in this current era.
Okay, so we've covered the working practices and the way they worked, and then you said they didn't have like some big advantage, and then I saw your eyes work, and you said, oh, maybe they did. What did they have? Some kind of like thing, like a magical crank made of gold and fleece?
They didn't have anything in particular in that area, but because they were working on everything at the same time,
right?
They didn't trip over stuff when they arrived at it, if you know what I mean. If you work in a linear fashion in Formula One, you're going to hit something. And then once you hit it, you can't go any further. You've then got to come back and then figure out which part of those steps then broke the chain. Whereas if you're working in various different areas and they're all building up together, you tend not to trip over too much, because everything that you trip over, you can just go one step back and it's not so detrimental.
And so with that Christmas tree shape, they've demanded, say, 20 points of downforce. I don't know whether 20 is high or low, but 20 points of downforce.
It's a lot.
In the floor, right? And, you know, Derek's team, he's got three different Derek's working on three different solutions all coming up together. So if the Derek solution they pick is wrong, they can go down to the rest of the team and pull things in without starting again. And of course, they've had the budget and the sheer force of staff to be able to do that, which is perhaps, Matt, an advantage that may bleed away with the cost cap.
Well, it may bleed away, but since we're talking about how about the uniqueness and the efficacy of Mercedes structure, could I just go ahead and ask, because it tends to come up a lot in conversation. Mercedes is classed as a works team, as is Red Bull and Ferrari and Renault, I guess. How much of an advantage is it? Like, I'm sure you can't put an actual number on it, but you could just go, like, it's a big honking advantage, and we would get the general idea. Like, from your point of view, from a technical point of view, how much of an advantage is it really for these teams to be able to work together versus just simply being a customer and saying, this is the basic shape of the power unit you get, go design your car?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, principally, the numbers is one huge element. I think, I don't know if you guys, which channel you guys log in to watch F1, but there was a comment during the season, which was that Haas, for example, are so small that Mercedes have more people on holiday at any one time than Haas has in its complete
That's
team.
Funny. I didn't know. Catch that.
So to put that into perspective, that gives you an idea of who can be working on X number of things at any one time. So that sheer force of people is one element. The other element of being a works team is that they can actually pull different strings within the Daimler group that a lot of people don't necessarily think about. And Daimler is a big company. So as much as it might be, I can't remember what the figures are, but near as makes no difference, 800 people in the Mercedes Grand Prix Limited business. Above that, there are all of the partners to that team, all of the technical partners, so all the companies that they outsource their additive manufacturing to. Sometimes they'll outsource some manufacturing of specific components, whether it's CNC manufacturing or even design of some elements, and they'll buy in some of those elements as well. But also the Daimler Group, which is enormous. So when they say to Daimler, right, this is worth X, Y, and Z in marketing, Daimler go, all right, you have my attention. What do you need? So then suddenly you've got the entire Daimler Group behind you. That's enormous. And that's really where the major, major difference between a works team and a customer team is, because a customer team only has whoever comes in through the doors to actually do what they can do. Of course, they have the outsourcing as well for some components, but not a huge amount.
Look, we're running low on time today, but please tell me that you and Race Car Engineering will come and visit us for a longer form power unit show at some point.
Yes, absolutely. We didn't even really get onto the power units all that much. There's a hell of a lot more to speak about there. And like I said, the bits that we did talk about aren't the tough parts. So yeah, we'll talk about that.
Matt, sure, don't panic. I can see Matt panicking. He'll come back. We haven't offended him. We can get Stuart Mitchell back at some point.
Well,
yes, indeed.
Before you go, at least tell us what you think the tough parts are, so we have something to be excited about for the next show.
Well, I can tell you one of the advantages that Mercedes have had in the power unit department is the ability to keep the MGUK on longer than a lot of the other manufacturers. The MGUK output is capped, but the amount of time that you can deploy it really depends on your hardware and software in that electrical powertrain. And what that means is keeping things cool and stopping them from derating is really the difficult part. And that's where some of the other teams have had to cut short the length of time that they deploy for because they don't have it.
Right. So I know, for example, in Formula E, that the cooling was often a challenge for the region early on and led to specific rules about how much you were allowed to do and capped overall outputs. So am I understanding that it's potentially a software and or a cooling solution that Mercedes has that other teams don't, that allow them this greater access to more MGUK deployment in terms of time overlap?
Yes, that's right. So is it going to be a combination of a couple of things? One is the way that they set up their battery itself. So the number of cells that they've got in different modules, how they control individual cells, how they control modules, how they control the overall pack. And that's basically underneath the umbrella of battery management system. Then with that information, the accuracy with which they can keep it within a temperature window. So then the cooling solution comes into play, and then monitoring all of that comes into software. And then, of course, the actual power they can get out depends on the cells themselves. So it's a combination.
Ah, okay. That got very technical, Matt. I got lost. Any follow-up from you?
Well, yeah, I have about 3 hours of follow-up on that on that response, but I'm thinking we may not have time for that today.
Okay, well, look, this is one of the key questions. It was actually the top of my list of questions to ask you, Stuart, was, look, we've seen this Mercedes domination happen since 2014. It's happened. 7 world titles. Next year looks like it might be a similar picture. You know, that's down to COVID. That's no one's fault. They extended the regulations out. Can Mercedes' engine advantage be overturned, or will we ever get to a point where that engine advantage isn't such a big advantage, like the olden days, where, yeah, you could have a better engine, but it wasn't like the dominating factor, maybe?
Unfortunately, with the regulations set as they are, the efficiency of the power unit, which includes the electrical side as well, is really, really, really important to lap time, because you're not only deploying energy like you were in the past when you were just burning air and fuel, but you're also recovering it back. And then you're using it where it's most necessary, and then you're recovering it where it's not most necessary. So really and truly understanding power management is one of the major, major tickets. And even when you see the likes of Mercedes being sort of pestered sometimes by the Red Bull, the Red Bull can only do that for so long, and then suddenly you see that it starts to tail off again. So it's not that Max Verstappen isn't a better driver or whatever, you know, that's not the case at all. It's that his car can do what it can do for so long, and then Mercedes can do it for a bit longer. So the answer is no. As far as power units are concerned, it's not going to change next year.
I'll just quick follow up on that from me, Matt, is that, like, you know, you see the advantage that Sergio Perez had holding off both of the Red Bulls at the Turkish Grand Prix. Yes, they were able to harass the Racing Points for a little while, but ultimately both fell away, one more spectacularly than the other. But that's that kind of inherent advantage that, you know, the Mercedes-powered cars seem to have.
Yeah, absolutely. But on an outright flying lap, there's not a huge amount of difference in it. We've spoken to all of the teams, and we've got a nominal output of around 1,000 horsepower, and the delta between the best and the worst being only about 25 horsepower, which is not a huge amount difference between the best and the worst. So when you think about it on one lap performance, they can all do it. They can all hit that target. Of course, aero comes into play, and then, you know, vehicle dynamics comes into play. But on paper, power unit wise, they could all be there or thereabouts, but they can't all keep it up for that long.
Matt, I've genuinely learned something there. Like, I just assumed that the Mercedes had more horsepower.
No, it's interesting to hear that the power units are that close in single lap output. And I guess before we go, is it then a terrifying thing, given that so much of it is now coming down to battery management and energy deployment over a longer course of time, that Mercedes Formula E team is now actually relocating to Brackley? Does that suggest they might be borrowing software solutions from the Formula E team to improve even more over what they've got?
It's Formula E and Formula One are the same in one respect, which is they're both energy limited formulas, because Formula E, of course, has a full battery pack, and you have, I believe it's 52 kilowatt hours of energy to use over the course of the race. Mercedes, all Formula One teams have 106 kilograms of fuel on board, and whatever they can recover from that over the course of the race. So they're both energy limited formulas. They're very different in the way that the development strategy goes. In Formula E, you can't do anything about the battery. You also can't do anything about the battery cooling. All you can do is your own software to manage the response from the battery. Whereas in Formula One, you have control of everything. And that isn't to say that the combustion engine is completely dead in terms of development in Formula One. There's still loads of energy being put into that, loads of resource being put into that. to get above and beyond that hallowed 50% thermal efficiency, which Mercedes have, celebrated. But there's still more to be had there. But the way that you engineer those two power units from the driveline side of things in Formula E and then the whole unit in Formula One is very, very different. But there will be some talk, and the more heads, going at one problem, the better. Simple as that, really.
I'm delighted that, Matt, you brought Formula E into it. Of course, in the news headlines in the UK, which some of our American listeners and beyond might be unaware of, is that by 2030, we will have no more sales of petrol or diesel cars in the UK. So all new cars being sold presumably will be electric. I'm guessing electric over hydrogen. But given that F1 is primarily based around UK teams, or a lot around UK teams, if F1 wants to keep relevant, and I feel like it does want to be road relevant, this whole all electric thing, that has accelerated that debate, hasn't it? And that's going to have an effect on future engines as well.
Certainly, but it's a very political conversation when you talk about the future of automobile powertrain. Because, of course, at the point of sale, electric vehicles have zero emission. But what needs to be worked on is the production side. So the manufacturing still has a long way to go before it's anywhere, remotely close to what's known as sustainable, or what's considered to be sustainable. So these vehicles at the point of sale, yes, they won't pollute.
Yeah.
And you won't suffocate if you're standing near one. But there's some benefits to be had from the likes of Formula One. But certainly I think the whole roadmap of electric vehicles will change in the near future.
I think if we resurface all the tracks with the same kind of tarmac that they used for the Turkish Grand Prix, we could power all electric vehicle production with spinning Formula One cars. There you go. I've solved it. I've solved it all. Stuart Mitchell, Deputy Editor of Race Car Engineering Magazine, please tell us where we should go to find out more from you, to buy your magazine and the other two publications involved with you guys as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, up-to-date information on various technical topics can be found at racecar-engineering.com. Of course, from there, you'll be able to pick up the magazine and buy it and go to the shop to get your subscriptions. Also, keep on board your Twitter feed, racecar@racecarengineer, and also check out our other publications coming out soon, which will be Historic Engineering. And we've also got an Anatomy of a Race Car, which is going to be published just before Christmas.
When that Historic Engineering magazine comes out, you've got to come back here and tell us all about it and tease that a bit for us as well. Stuart Mitchell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Fantastic interview there with Stuart Mitchell. Go and check out Race Car Engineering magazine. We've got an interview with Tony Cohen Brown coming up next, but I wanted to address something that I've been neglecting for some time, which is listener feedback. And we do get mail all the time, and I tend to respond to it all personally, but I've never put aside time in the show to say, oh, give you a shout out or talk about some of the topics that have come up on those messages. So in future, me and Matt will sit with some of the emails and we'll use those as topic discussions in dedicated feedback sections like this when we've got interviews pre-recorded. But just on this occasion, I want to give a shout out to a few people who wrote lengthy emails. Not going to read all of them, don't worry. But it's lovely that people take the time. And just know that if you've emailed me, I've definitely read it. Now I'm going to get better at acknowledging that as part of the show as well. So Dieter from Adelaide says, hi, Spanners. I've been listening to your podcast for just over a year, and I look forward to listening to you guys every Monday. That's fantastic. You've built up a wonderful community and remained independent, allowing yourself freedom to release good content. Keep up the good work, mate, says Dieter. Yes, being independent actually is a real thing, because whilst we are grateful to our patrons, we're not obliged to them for any particular kind of content. I think our patrons would prefer us to just be honest and say what we want to say. It's very clear with some of the other podcasts that they are hamstrung slightly from what they can say. And if you've got a paymaster who, you know, has to think about a broader journal, you know, or a website that they're attached to, then that's completely understandable. I myself have work like that where I'm not free to just say whatever I want. So it's understandable, but as an independent podcast, we do get to say what we want. I just wanted to say, continues Dieter, that when you talked about the Spanish Grand Prix, I have to say I agreed with everything you said. I too enjoyed the Grand Prix, and while it wasn't the greatest Grand Prix in history, I thoroughly enjoyed it too. And I too was disappointed in what people were saying on social media about it being a boring race. So I'll skip forward a little bit, but Dieter says, when you watch a series like Drive to Survive, where they have lots of edited highlights, you might get the impression that the races were always dramatic with lots of collisions. But the reality is there are many different types of race every season, and that's a good feature about F1. Some races have on-track drama, and some are all about strategies, and some are about luck and the weather. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Dieter from Adelaide, South Australia. Yeah, the city we used to have a Grand Prix here many years ago, lol. Thank you for that as well. And I think you might be right. I think if you come into F1 watching a highlights package like Drive to Survive, then yeah, it's very easy to sit here and go, oh my gosh, that's not anything like that. But you know, those of us who've been watching it for 30, 40 years will tell you that, you know, in the 90s, we had a lot of races like this year's Spanish Grand Prix. However, this year has also given us some absolute stonking thrillers. I'm hard pushed to think of a season where we had so many dramatic high action races as we've had this season, and they've come thick and fast as well. So I think it's been an incredible season in many ways. Now, a series of emails along the same lines, and they're from Daniel and Andrew and Will. Well, let's see. Andrew says, on the topic of being kind, I just wanted to reach out after listening to the Portugal review and thank you for not shying away from the harder topics that came up and framing them with compassion and kindness. I appreciated it. I appreciate it with the We Racers 1 discussions, and even more so this week. And look, this was around the Max Verstappen comments, and they were very difficult comments for a lot of people to hear, and I didn't shy away from talking about that, and I don't think I should either. If the whole show was about it, I think people could rightly get upset. But the odd comment on a social issue, guys, relax, it's life, you know? We've all got these things on our mind, and I'm not going to sit here and say to the panel, oh, every single time a social issue pops up in F1, shh, be quiet, because some people are going to be offended. You know, being offended by social issues is kind of weird. And if we were spending 20 minutes talking about it, then yeah, I get you. you can tune out, which is why, for example, when we had Lindsay Orridge on the other day, I put it at the end of a show and I told you what it was going to be. So you can decide to listen to that or not listen to that. Will said, hi, I just donated to the tip jar. Thanks, Will. Really, honestly, makes a huge difference. The Patreon support really gives us that secure drum beat in the background, enabling us to do things. When people drop tip jars in, part goes to Matt. He can do whiskey if he wants. But we tend to sort of put that aside and go, that is like a war chest. That is our war chest. When a mixer breaks, when a mic breaks, when we want to upgrade, those tip jar donations are just incredible. Like, you have powered this shed, literally. MissedApexPodcast.com/tip jar. Thank you, Will. The tipping jar was because I thought Spanners spoke excellently. It would have been easy to shy away and say stick to talking about F1. And I think you really struck the right note and did the right thing. Thank you. Thank you, Will. That means a lot. And I know, and even now I know this bit is annoying some people. I know we lost listeners from me talking about those topics, all the ones that have been mentioned. Before the one early on in the season, I literally had to we sat down and had a chat with my wife and said, you know, we know we're going to lose some people. And we did. I know we lost people. But maybe we kept the right people. We lost people, maybe we kept the right people. People like Will. But like I said, not going to go on about it. And the listener feedback is complete. And now you know that if you send me an email, there's a chance you'll get a shout out on the show in these listener feedback segments. I think we should talk more F1. We've got a great interview coming up for you right now. And we're joined live in the shed today by a creator that is bringing some of the harder terminology down to earth for rookie F1 fans and maybe fans like me of Formula One who have just arrogantly swum their way through their F1 fandom, never really paying attention. The questions that you were always too afraid to ask, well, now you can ask them because we have the creator of a new TikTok sensation channel with us, and we are joined by Tony Cohen Brown. Tony, welcome to the shed.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right, so you have been answering rookie questions and F1 noob questions for people on TikTok. Firstly, why TikTok?
That's a great question. I'm always curious about new mediums. I love discovering different channels and I'm just curious. I work in tech, so TikTok has gotten a lot of clout recently and a lot of interest for a variety of reasons, mostly because they've said that they want to ban it. So that got me curious about it. But I also just wrote a guide, which I initially thought was going to be a quick, you know, 10, 12 pager guide, which is absolutely impossible to do in F1. Turned out to be a 54 pager for beginners. And I started TikTok actually because I was getting questions from an increasing amount of friends who started to watch F1, mostly because they got interested with Drive to Survive, which has been absolutely fascinating. And I was just getting questions in the middle of races, text messages, voice memos. And I was just replying in every way, shape or form I could, was responding via text message or responding with a video. And then it just got me thinking that actually TikTok is a great medium to just quickly answer questions that are on people's mind. And it's worked very well, actually, easier than the 52-pager guide.
So you did that blog. It actually doesn't do it justice. Like you said, it's a guide. But the fact with the TikToks is you can take one question, and then with TikTok, it's a very short format medium. So you have to get to the core of the answer as quickly as possible. And I think that's what's captured people's imagination.
Truly. And our attention span these days has just gotten ridiculous. I see it with myself that trying to watch a movie for 2 hours has become impossible. After the 30, 40 minute mark, I'm kind of itching to press pause. And that's because I started watching more TV shows than movies. And so, it really does work beautifully. And it's helped me. I'm a long format type of person. So it's helped me be succinct. And I honestly think if you can't answer questions in 60 seconds, you probably don't understand it fully. So it's helped me realize where I've got gaps and where there's much more understanding to do, which has been fun.
I like that you talked about attention span. As a 40-year-old, the example I always put forward is E.T. a film I loved as a child. I tried to show that to my children, and boy, that thing is slow. So I have really kind of, I've come around to just accepting that I no longer have any attention span, and your TikTok videos are probably exactly the same, exactly the right length. But how challenging has it been? Firstly, hang on, what's the name of the TikTok channel? How do we get to it?
It's just Tony Cowan Brown, I think. No, it's T. Cowan Brown.
T. Cowan Brown. Go. Okay, good.
Someone else has Tony Cowan Brown, which I'm mad about.
Yes. Someone else has been sitting on missedapex.com for a long time as well.
They said, I feel you.
I know. They said they'd give me the email, but they won't give me the website. So how challenging has it been, though? How tested have you been by these new questions that have come in?
Very tested, I'm not going to lie. It's been fascinating, actually, the breadth and the depth of the questions. You've got the basic, you've got what seemingly comes across as a basic question that I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's an easy one. And then as I start putting it together or trying to formulate an answer, I realize actually it's way more complicated. So a nice example was, you know, well, why does Red Bull have two teams? And I was like, you know, and the question was, why does Red Bull have two teams? And is AlphaTauri truly a, you know, a development team? And so what was interesting to see with that was, oh, wait a minute, actually, people have a misunderstanding of what the relationship between the different teams. And so what got me thinking is people were asking, well, isn't that just the same with, you know, Ferrari and Alfa Romeo? It's like, oh no, that's a difference. There's the difference between a constructor team and a works team. And so basically by answering one question, you realize there's another question that needs to be answered before that and another one before that, which has been great. But I have been tested with some fantastic questions.
And by the way, Matt Trumpets is still here. But Matt, isn't this, you know, one of those cases where, like, when you talk to a small child, they will ask questions that you just didn't think about asking. And in a way, new F1 fans, you are the children of F1 fandom. So sometimes a kid asks something simple and you go, ha, 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 are you innocent, chut? Well, hang on a minute. Yeah, that is harder than I first thought.
Yeah.
Once you realize you're going to have to explain the second law of thermodynamics to your 5-year-old to give them a proper answer,
right.
It does get a bit complicated. And I will say, like, I'm impressed because, let's face it, Formula One is between drivers on track, but it's also a battle between engineers. And it's been my observation that whenever engineers get involved, nothing is simple. Like the direction turn right, you'd think would be simple, but give it to engineers and you'll have 10 pages of bullet points as to how to actually just turn the car right.
Right. So, Tony, as a new content creator, what can be actually quite a hostile space, F1 Twitter, I don't know if F1 TikTok is aggressive in that same way. But just how have you found it, putting that content up? Your TikTok's gained reasonable traction considering how recent it is. Have people been generally nice?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll tell you an anecdote there, which is fascinating. I was born in France, grew up in Brussels, so lived pretty close to the Spa-Francorchamps racetrack, and then moved to London. So was moving sort of a little bit, in my opinion, further away from the initial relationship that I had with F1, and then recently moved to SF. And that gap has just gone bigger and bigger, which is just fascinating. So I've started to look online more than I ever have previously for communities and people to engage with. And I have to say, I was very nervous, for example, of joining the subreddit, which has got 1.2 million fans in there. But I've loved the space, interestingly. I found it very welcoming. With TikTok, what's interesting is the hostile people on TikTok have actually helped me grow my audience by being who they are, by pointing out that I might have not answered the question fully or by saying that they don't like my accent. And I'm just like, bring it on, because the more you comment and the more you're angry about this, the more traction I get. So there's a way of looking at it that's beneficial, I think.
I love that. The way you speak doesn't precisely suit my exact needs from a channel. Therefore, I'm going to write something horrible.
And people are, and look, this is the reality of the internet, but it's also the reality of the globalized world in which we live in today, is people see me, I'm pale, I'm redhead, I'm clearly a Brit, whereas I was actually born in France, grew up in France first, I'm bilingual, my first language was French. So when I say, which is the one that got really people riled up on TikTok, Renault, which is the only way I can say Renault, or maybe one of you needs to say it in the British
accent. Are you trying to say Hanau? Is that?
That's the one.
Right, okay. Well, that's how we say it. I don't know the correct way to say it. I'm sure Matt says it like Hanotas.
Renault.
Renault. There you go. And it's just interesting that there is no correct way to even listen.
Sorry, were you saying the team Renault?
Fascinating. What did you think I was saying?
I thought you were saying the venue Hanau.
You are the second person to do that to me in a week when I explain this story.
Sorry. Okay. Let's get to the crux of it. You have some examples of some of the questions that you've been given, and some of them I think people will be expecting questions where I know the answer. I've been watching F1 forever. Some of them are quite surprising. We also asked our patron Slack group. Gosh, they're the best people. Yes. You can be like them and support us at patreon.com/missedapex. They also have stepped up and they have put their pride aside. And they've said, you know what? I don't know this thing. And I've been too afraid to ask. So we've got a nice mix. Why don't we start, Tony, with one of the questions that you've brought along?
So one that I loved that I got recently was just very simply, can you explain qualifications in F1? Which I thought was a brilliant question.
Yes.
And, it sounds pretty basic. And then when you start to break it down it's shifted over the years. It's changed. Now you've got, your Friday sessions of free practices, and you've got Saturday, you have qualifications, but also just explaining what Q1, Q2 and Q3 is, and explaining sort of the dropout of, for the first 20 minutes, all the cars get together, they go on the track, they try and set the fastest record, and the slowest five cars get eliminated and they go back for Q2. And then what I found interesting was the conversation about, which tires do you have to use, and why do the people who've got into Q2 have to use those tires to kick off the race? And how is it that the top 10 can choose what tires they want? And it's like this question of, you're allowing to level the playing field.
It's amazing how often seemingly seasoned F1 fans miss that Q2 isn't about ultimate pace with the top teams.
That's it.
Yeah. And people are going, look at that. Hamilton's nowhere. It's like, no, dude, that's his race tire that he's got to start on. And Matt, I know you're all about the tires, but we come up against this all the time, even within circles where we would think people would know the qualifying format in and out. It's actually reasonably complex.
Well, exactly. It is. And the strategic implications of it are as well, particularly, I think, for the teams that finish near the back of the third qualifying session. It can actually sometimes they're better off if they don't make that session, which is an interesting thing.
And I think, Tony, something that people miss these days as well is the extra tire that they're given in Q3. Is that even a thing anymore, by the way? Do they get an extra soft tire in Q3? I've forgotten.
I think they do.
Yeah,
You see, this is what's great. Now that you've asked it, your mind starts going, I don't know, was that 2019 rules? Have I missed something?
Yeah. But the thing that people sometimes miss, Matt, is that why hasn't Sainz gone out in Q3? Well, frankly, because he'd be better off saving a set of tires for the race, for example.
Yeah. It's often the case that some of the teams will send out for their first qualifying run in the final session, they'll send their runners out on used soft tires because they don't have the extra save set that some of the faster teams who can just do a single run in the first qualifying session, for example. That's something that I think a lot of people, that not just a lot of people, but broadcasters will miss that. He finished 10th. We thought he was going to be faster. Well, he's running an old set of tires.
I also wonder with the broadcasters whether they're doing the opposite of what Tony's doing, which is they don't want to keep repeating stuff as if they have an uneducated audience. In American commentary, they are more than happy to spew the basics time and time again. But I think there's an assumed thing with the British audience that you are already somewhat well-versed, and that can lead to people being kind of left behind. And so I really love that you're doing this, Tony.
It's interesting you say that, because I think there's also an understanding of the audience is somewhat different in Europe versus America, where the barrier to entry is maybe a little higher in America as well, in that the race is at 5, 6 a.m. in the morning. So if you're going to sit down and watch the race at that, that early on in the morning, you're willing to be educated at the same time.
And Matt, Americans watching it at that time, they don't even have the benefit of whiskey at that time in the morning.
Oh, no, not at all. Never.
Why don't we get to some of our Slack patrons' questions that they were too afraid to ask, Matt?
Okay. Well, here's a good one. We actually fortunately had someone show up who is a brand new fan And one of the questions they asked is, what's the real benefit of letting F2 drivers take part in the first practice? And doesn't that take away from the actual driver, the real driver's time to get used to the car and the track?
Who asked that question, Matt?
That would be F1 Rookie, a very eponymously named person.
Love that question. Someone actually on TikTok asked me a similar question in that, shouldn't we just abolish free practice sessions, which got me thinking about the importance of letting F2 drivers, you know, take part in the races. I do think it's their one. Let me take a step back. The thing I think I personally forget a lot is just how hard it must be to practice to be an F1 driver, because you can't just jump into an F1 car and just practice. Like, it's just not a thing like most sports where you can pick up a football or you can pick up a tennis racket. And so the allowing your F2 drivers to do that free practice sessions when they can, I just think it's a way of showcasing the talent. I think it's also a fascinating moment for F1 fans to see what's coming, like what to get us excited about the new talent that's out there. So I don't know if that really completely answers your questions, but those two elements kind of
so
seem exciting.
Firstly, slightly offended, as amateur sim racers, me and Matt are entirely convinced that our iRacing experience fully prepares us for a career in F1.
100%.
Hey, I'm sure it does.
And also,
step closer.
You also, I guess we can't ignore the fact that a lot of teams simply take finances to put drivers in those seats. So it's a form of revenue for the drivers. The broader question that you got on TikTok is, you know, why not get rid of practice? Obviously, this year we were robbed in Mugello, I think, of Friday practice. And then at Imola, it was scheduled to miss the Friday. And I missed a lot, you know, and people are saying, well, it mixed stuff up, Matt. But I missed out on my Friday experience of tuning into Jack, Jolyon and Jenny. And listening to things. And the thing is, if people don't want Friday practice, it's not compulsory. You don't have to watch Friday practice. I don't understand why people want to take it away from me.
Well, see, I was interested to see what Tony actually thought about that, because we've had quite the raging argument.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's some benefits to both sides there. So I was curious how you felt about it or what you concluded.
I concluded that, I mean, we saw it and it was asked to me just after Istanbul. And I was just like, if you would have taken free practice sessions away for Istanbul, the race that we just had, I think qualifications would have been an absolute nightmare. And I am more focused on the sportsmanship than I am maybe on the entertainment piece of it. And I just don't want this to turn into some, you know, fun entertainment. So I also, and similarly, I actually enjoy tuning in and watching all of the coverage that I can and watching them learn. I think it must be very humbling to go out there during your free practice sessions and discover a track sometimes for the first time and see people, how they navigate that and see the growth throughout the free practice sessions and in qualifying. So I like it. Similar to the Spanners, don't take it away.
Yeah, don't take it away from me. The same as winter testing. People are, oh, what's the point in winter testing? The point is, I have very little in my life. I am a 40-year-old father of two. Why are you taking away the small points of joy in my life outside of getting gently sozzled once everybody's gone to sleep? Right, Tony.
Love this.
Too much? Tony, give us your next one that you've armed yourself with.
I'll tell you another one that came in that I loved that I've been trying to wrap my head around is the budget caps that are coming and what can the budget be actually spent on. And the reason I bring this one up is obviously it's a new thing that they're allocating or they're putting a cap on the budget that you can spend for the car development. But what got me interested is seeing that the budget cap doesn't include things like driver salaries, which is, I think is important, although that's another question that's happening, but also things that I didn't know, such as senior team officials, marketing and hospitality. It also excludes salary costs from staff members who are on paternity leave and maternity leave, which I kind of find pretty cool for a sport that's very male oriented or male driven. So there's some fun, quirky things that came out of that about the salary cap.
Well, of course, I know what you're saying, the budget cap. We had, obviously, Matthew Carter talking about this. And given that he ran Lotus F1, as the CEO, when I say team manager, I kept saying the ex-team manager of Lotus F1. He was like, dude, the team manager is like the guy who sorts out like the catering and stuff like that. Oh, sorry. So ex-CEO Matthew Carter instantly said to us, didn't he, Trumpist? He went, well, that budget cap, it doesn't include this, this, and this. And as a team boss, he instantly just saw that the budget cap wouldn't have given him any advantage over the top teams.
Yeah, basically, it's got more holes in it than the tax code of the Cayman Islands, if I'm being honest.
I'm laughing as if I know finances. Right. Okay, good. Why don't we get another one of our Slack questions, Matt?
All right. Well, here's a good one. What happens if you blow through all of your tires? Are you just at a did not finish at that point?
So I love this question. I'm not actually sure I have the right answer to this, but my feeling is, I think as Spanner mentioned at one point, it's just like you've clearly had a crappy day.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to be handed another set of tires after you've blown through all of them, but if you're a driver, you probably do. I honestly don't know. I think do you call it quits? Do you get another tire?
So I also do not know, Matt, which is fine. Do not know, I don't know is a perfectly acceptable answer. I always assumed that if you run out of new tires, and I think we're talking new tires, you just have to go onto old tires. And if you've had that bad a weekend that all of your tires have been blown through, like if that had happened to me, I would just go home. It would be, it's like Bottas when they were like, what tires do you want to go on? I would have just go, I'm just going to go home. Matt.
Which ones will take me out of the race most quickly, please? Those are the ones I would like. Okay, so this isn't fair because tires are something that I actually pay a lot of attention to. And I may have included it only because the word tires was in the question without reading the rest of it first. So I apologize if I caught you by surprise there.
It's got me thinking.
They give you an allotment of tires to start the week. And then at certain points in free practice one and free practice two, they take certain tires away. And then when you get to the race, you have a certain number of tires left, some of which will be new tires that you've not raced on. One set will be the if you're in the top qualifying session, will be your Q2 tires that you set your best time on. And then you've got whatever new tires and whatever used tires left to get through the rest of the race. So Spanners, annoyingly, was basically correct, is if you've gone through all the new tires, they just will put you on old tires.
I mean, it happens a lot. I'm proper wise, especially when it comes to tires. What, Matt? What?
In fact, here is your bonus piece of trivia for the week.
Listening.
The enters that Lewis Hamilton switched onto at the Turkish Grand Prix, the ones that he did 50 laps on, they were used. They weren't even new.
What a legend. And I don't have my corn fork with me, so I'm not going to be stabbing myself with it whilst I do that bit of ham-fossiness that they were actually used. So, yeah, I think it's an advantage to go onto new tyres, especially with the dry tyres. And if you blow through your new tyre allocation, that's it. You're just burdened with some old tyres. Tony, we promised we'd only keep you 20 minutes or so. We've already gone over that. But allow me to take this massive liberty and assume that you won't have a diva moment and be like, no, you said 20 minutes, and ask you to give us maybe 1, 2, 3, or 4 final beginner's questions that you've been asked.
Of course, I'm happy to. One that's maybe on top of everyone's mind right now is, do you think Checo could replace Albon at Red Bull? Which it's interesting because I get a mix of very specific questions, very technical, and then I get a mix of, what do you think? Which is always, I don't know, I haven't thought about that. And my answer was on this one is, look, I'll give you not my personal take, but I'll give you the wider take here, which I thought is interesting.
Okay.
Which is mostly, I think we seem to forget that it's not just about the driver or it's not just about the car. It's about it all meshing and coming together. So you've got to find the right team with the right strategy, with the right driver. And I think Checo's personality and driving will match.
Yes, correct answer. Well done. Phew, we were on dodgy
ground.
Did
I pass?
Yeah, we were on dodgy ground.
You're more stressful than my TikTok audience. I feel like I'm getting graded here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to put a yellow card or a red card.
I was convinced that he set you up with that question because he is a massive Perez Fossey.
No. I'm neutral. I'm really neutral. Uh-huh.
Yeah, right.
Even I can tell that's not true. But again, a seemingly basic question led to actually other people saying, oh, I hadn't thought of teams, right team, right ethos, right driver, right strategy, right timing. Does Checo want to be a number two? Does he care? Does he just want to drive? All of these questions.
Are you assuming that Perez would be a number two at Red Bull? Okay, that stabs through my heart, but for the sake
of our new...
I think they'll give each other a run for their money and they'll both level the playing field. That's my take.
Honestly, it is Max Verstappen's team. Max Verstappen is fantastic and fantastically fast. Sergio Perez, by his own admission, is not the out-and-out fastest driver on the grid. I fully expect that to be something like a 15-5 qualifying battle in favor of Max
23
Verstappen.
23-0.
Yeah, you can shut your stupid face. Oh my God.
I mean, look, I'm not disparaging Perez at all. But the fact of the matter is, he is not the fastest in qualifying.
Yeah.
Ocon beat him. I think Stroll is tied with him or close. But in the races, and we've talked about this, in the races, he has an ability to get more out of those tires than almost anyone else on the grid. And that's how he puts the good results together.
Okay, so you're putting it just down to time management. That's fine. I'm going to pretend I'm not triggered and move to Tony and say, it is interesting you get those kind of questions because it opens up, especially with Perez, the difference between a pay driver, a supported driver, a driver who brings cash, a driver who brings media, who brings sponsorship, and a pure out-and-out talent driver. I mean, that's a whole... Do you ever get to the end of your TikToks and go... Do you know what? I'm just going to... How long is a maximum TikTok?
It's 15 seconds or max 60 seconds.
Really?
Very rarely. I'm going to be honest here. Very rarely do I answer anything in under 15 seconds. Someone asked, what does DNF stand for? That's maybe the only one that I was able to answer in 15 seconds. But yeah, you get 60 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, right. I didn't realize that. I don't know if you can do... Are they threaded? Can you do threaded ones or no?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No, it's succinct at its best.
Okay, you can't do like link to part two or anything like that. Oh, crazy.
It's a great media strategy. It's great to get people hooked.
Even with DNF, you can use that as a platform to then talk about, DNF did not finish, but then you can go through the difference between DNF and DNS and how that affects all the stats. And Matt has thrown up his arm in the air, which means he's going to point out something stupid I said, and I'm going to be sad.
Well, no, I always thought... DNF stood for drastically nasty finish. No?
Stupid.
No, but hey, I like that version better.
Right. We're out of time, more or less, Tony. But have we left enough of a not negative impression with you for you to come back and join us, not only for more stupid questions, but maybe on a panel sometime as well?
No question is stupid.
Thank you. I was going to say that. And that's my rule on TikTok. There's no stupid questions. There's only stupid people.
Okay. Tony, I'm going to have to ask you to explain that to like all of the YouTube commenters on our channel.
I know.
Because they are very sure that a lot of my questions are stupid. Like they are evangelically convinced.
I spend my day asking questions. So I'm happy to spend some of my day answering questions. I think the more we ask, especially with a sport like this, the more you ask questions, the more great answers you get and the more into, and actually I think truthfully, the more into the sport you get, the more you realize it's so layered.
Matt, layered, getting into the depths of it. This is why we do Whose Fault Is It? That's why we don't do racing incidents. That's why we assign blame, not just as a reflection of my appalling point scoring toxic marriage, but also so that we can drill down into the ethos of racing.
I love it.
Yeah, because it's not always a clear-cut answer. And I love that you're creating a space where people can judgment-free ask about things that they might feel would be gatekept about in other places.
Yes. In fact, we're making assumptions, Tony. You might turn around on some of those TikToks and go, "You idiot! I'm not answering that, moron."
Actually, I've had to do the opposite. I've had to put my foot down and say, because what you get is you get the, I don't want to call them hardcore fans, but the uber fans, you're like, that's an idiot question. Every true F1 fan knows the answer to that. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm just going to delete your comment, block you, and I'm give space to the people who ask the questions because I've got no time for that, quite frankly.
No true F1 fan. I hate that. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as a true F1 fan.
And also the sport is evolving constantly. Like that's what I've discovered in the last 2 months is there's no way to stay on top of everything unless you're asking a dozen questions every hour, which is great. Keep us occupied.
In typical Miss Apex fashion, we prepped twice as much material as we needed for this show. So that is at least one dedicated Tony Cowan-Brown drop-in. And we hope you will join us on a panel soon. But please do tell our listeners where to go and find you. And if you are short of attention, you can just go to the show notes and we will have lots of handy links in the show notes in the YouTube and on your app. I think you swipe right on Android, and on Apple, you send a check to Apple or something and they will show you the show notes. But where can people find you?
You can find me on TikTok at tcarenbrown, or just check out the website tonycarenbrown.com, which I also have my 54-page guide if you're really bored one day. That's how you find me.
54 pages is a lot. Are they short pages, or is it 54 extremely long pages?
No, good. Of course not. But I got some nice thumbs up from the people at F1 that they kind of liked it. So I'm just like, oh, okay, that I'll take that. But yeah, I guess you've got long form and then you've got the short version, 60 seconds. So this should be something there for everyone.
Hopefully. Tony Cohen Brown, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all we've got for you for this show. But you can join us live at 8 p.m. next Sunday. That's 8 p.m. UK time, GMT. You can join us live on YouTube for our live stream. Search for Missed Apex Podcast on YouTube and you can watch and chat along with the live chat room. You can follow me at Spanners Ready, the show at Missed Apex F1, and Matt at MattPT55. If you want to follow any of our guests, then click on the links in the show notes right now. We'll see you next week. Until then, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.